Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Book Club. So in today's episode, I tackle chapters 10 through 12 of Ben Okoro's Famished Road. We're currently accompanying Azaru through all of his travels, but we're strongly rooting for him. But I hope you enjoy and have a really good weekend. Bye. Chapter 10. When we parted from the crowd that was busily generating her myth, Dad led us through the bush paths and into the forest. I walked in a drunken haze beside him. We passed a tree whose lower branches were covered with yellow dresses. A black cat followed us from a distance. It was dark in the forest till we got to a clearing. In the middle of the clearing, a solitary wooden pole had been stuck into the earth. The pole had burst into flower. Little buds had grown out along its length, and some of the buds had opened into the beginnings of branches. Dad said, "This is what you must be like. Grow wherever life puts you down." I stared at the flowering pole. Then, touching my head affectionately, Dad told me to stay there and wait for him. He went off and I listened to his footsteps receding to the forest. A yellow wind stirred the leaves. Branches cracked. An animal cried out. The black cat, eyes aglow, ran past me in the direction Dad had gone. It looked back at me once. I waited. Noises accumulated in the forest. An owl flew over my head and watched me from a branch. I heard footsteps approaching and I could have sworn that they belonged to a heavy man. But when I looked, I saw an antelope. It came up to me, stopped near the pole, and stared at me. Then it came close and licked my feet. When the branch cracked amongst the trees, the antelope started and ran off. I waited, motionless. It began to drizzle. Water flowed down the invisible paths of the forest and collected at my feet. Again, I heard converging footsteps all around me. Then I saw something move. The air swelled. A woman stepped out of a tree and limped towards me. Her head hung loosely on her neck. She stared at me from her shapeless face, and she walked with her body leaning in one direction. She was deformed in a way I couldn't define. She had on a white robe. Her eyes were dark and small. When she got quite close to me, she stopped and started laughing. I didn't move. The wind startled the branches. The water at my feet made me shiver. The woman, laughing rather dementedly, walked around me. Her face was twisted and her eyes shone in the darkening light. When she was in front of me again, she slowly stretched her hands out towards my neck. At the same moment, the owl, uttering its nocturnal cry, flew from the branch and swooped past, circling us twice. It made another cry and soared upwards. A crack sounded, like a tree splitting, and I saw the owl falling, as though it had been shot in the mid-air of a dream. It landed on the earth and struggled, wings flapping feebly. Then it turned into a little pool of yellow water and evaporated into the air. The woman stopped laughing. Instead of reaching for my neck with her rough hands, she grabbed the flowering pole and began pulling it out of the earth, a satanic expression on her face. She wrenched the pole, and she had to keep pulling because it had developed strong roots. When she had successfully wrenched out the pole, along with its deep roots, she turned and dragged it behind her. As I watched her limping away, I noticed among the roots a glistening black snake covered with earth. The snake wound its way up the pole towards the woman's hands as she dragged it with her deeper into the forest. After a while, I didn't see her anymore. Then I heard a sharp cry, then silence. I did not move. It had begun to grow very dark. A millipede climbed up my leg and I did not disturb it. I saw the black cat again. It came towards me, slunk past and ran off in the direction we had originally come from. Not long afterwards, I saw Dad emerging from the forest with a great sack on his shoulder. He looked exhausted, as if he had been wrestling with demons. When he got to where I was standing, he said, "Did you move?" "No." "Good." I reached down and flicked the millipede off my leg. "Did you see anything happen?" "A woman came out of a tree. An owl fell down and turned to air. Water gathered at my feet." "Excellent," he said. "Let's go home." We set off. I didn't see the black cat anymore. I asked Dad, "Why did the woman tear the pole out of the earth?" "What pole?" "The one that was there." "Where?" "There." "There wasn't a pole there." I didn't speak for a while, then I said, "A snake came out of its roots and bit her." "That's good. Life is full of riddles that only the dead can answer," was Dad's reply. We went home in silence. We went down numerous paths. A dog limped in front and then it stopped to stare at us. Blood dripped from the sack on Dad's shoulder. Blood had widened and dried on the bandage on his forehead. "What did you catch?" I asked. "A wild boar." "Why are you bleeding?" "The trap caught the boar and it didn't die. It was still struggling when I got there. I had to kill it with my hands. It kicked my head." I walked behind him in silence, listening to the forest noises and to the sound of his breathing. The journey home seemed longer than the journey out. When we came to the palm wine bar, the madame was nailing up her signboard. I couldn't read its legend in the dark. She regarded us as we passed. Dad saluted her, she didn't reply. When we got to our new home, the children ran out to meet us. The men came to help Dad with the sack, but he didn't want any help. The woman talked excitedly. Our door was open. Folding chairs had been arranged all around the tiny place. The center table was loaded with drinks. There was a bowl of kola nuts and kowling on the floor. There was the potent aroma of fresh stew in the air. The room was empty. Dad went to the backyard and we found Mum in the kitchen. She was fanning the wood fire, tears running down her face, a mighty pot on the grate. When she saw us, she came out and held Dad tight and picked me up. Dad put the sack down on the kitchen floor. He looked at me for a moment and said, "I have kept my promise." Then he went out of the kitchen to the room, came back with towel and soap, fetched water from the well and had a long bath. I stayed with Mum in the kitchen, coughing when she coughed. The water boiled in the pot. Women of the compound came and helped her with getting the boar out of the sack. They poured boiling water on its skin, loosening its hair. They shaved it. 5 men helped them butcher the fierce-looking animal. They decapitated it, cut it to pieces and cut it out its monstrous intestines. Then the women began the cooking of the wild animal that Dad had caught in the forest. When the meat was cooking, on another fire a great pan was sizzling with oil. The whole compound smelled of aromatic stew, peppers, onions, wild earthy herbs, and frying bush meat. When everyone could be seen salivating in anticipation, Mom made me go and bathe. I wore a new set of clothes. Visitors and compound dwellers came one by one to our room. They took their seats. Mom combed my hair and gave me a parting. Dad also had a parting. Mom bathed. In the bathroom, she dressed up in her fine clothes. She did her hair and made up her face in the passage. Soon our little room was crowded with all kinds of people. Many of them were from our compound. One or two were from our previous habitation. A few of them were total strangers, and a lot of them were children. It was hot in the room and everyone sweated. All the chairs were filled and all the floor space taken. A woman struck up a song. A man struck up a more vigorous song. The children looked on. Mom came in with a plate of alligator pepper seeds, a saucer of cigarettes and breadfruit. And then we heard a flourish outside. It was Dad. He was at the doorway with an empty bottle in one hand, a spoon in the other. He was beating a tune out of glass. He wore a black French suit and had a fresh change of bandages. An eagle's feather stuck out from the back of his head. He looked happy and a little drunk. He came in beating his metallic tune on glass, dancing and singing to the music of his own invention. The crowd laughed, sharing in appreciation. Everyone began to chatter. Voice rose in volume. Jokes passed across the sweating faces. I felt a stranger amidst the celebration of my homecoming. Then to our delight, a woman appeared at the door, sounding a heraldic song. Mom came in with 3 women, carrying a great steaming pot of stew. Behind her were 3 more women, bearing basins of jollof rice, yams, beans, eba, and fried plantains. Children brought in paper plates and plastic cutlery. The aroma of the marvelous cooking overpowered the room. Everyone straightened. Faces were bright with aroused appetites. There wasn't a single throat that didn't betray the best hopes for a feast of abundant cooking in which all anticipation could be fully rewarded. Chapter 11. The food was brought in and covered in a corner. Everyone talked to disguise the flood of their salivation. The oldest man in the compound stood up and called for silence. The jokes, chatter, invented nicknames and robust arguments peppered the air, increasing the heat of the room. The call for silence was repeated. It too became a cause of much jesting. Dad had to raise his voice and threaten the crowd with his good arm before the noise became controllable. The old man made a libation at both posts of the door and prayed for us and thanked the ancestors that had been found and asked that I never be lost again. When he finished his prayer, he launched into a long rambling speech in which he welcomed us to the compound as new tenants, in which he aimed a few well-turned barbs at real and imaginary enemies, Anuiti released a torrent of proverbs and sores and anecdotes that fell like stones to the depths of our hunger. The longer his speech went on, the more depressed the faces became. His proverbs made us more famished, edgy, and irritable. When the old man had satisfied his hunger for speechmaking, Dad replied to his good wishes. He expressed gratitude for our general safety and good health, and prayed for all those present. The old man broke the kola knot. He gave a loaf to Dad, who chewed off a bit and passed it on, prayer laden, to Mum and then to me. The drinks were distributed to the crowd. There were large quantities of ogogoro and palm wine for the men, stout for the women, soft drinks for the children. While the drinks were being poured and handed over expectant faces sweating with thirst, one of the men struck up a song, and a woman said, "The only time men start to sing is when the food is ready." The woman burst out laughing, and the man's song was drowned in mockery. The women began a lovely song of their own in village choir voices. But Dad, ever mischievous, picked up the empty bottle and tamped away at it with a spoon and spoiled the rhythm of the women. Then everyone fell to singing their different songs. And for a moment, there was no discord amongst the many voices. The feast became a little rowdy. The room was too small to hold the vast number of people squashed into every available space, and even the walls creaked in protest. Clothes fell down from nails and lines. Dad's words passed from hand to hand, precipitating many jokes, and were eventually thrown out of the window. The room was so hot that everyone sweated furiously. The heat made everyone look older. The children cried, intensifying the edginess and hunger. But the drink loosened tongues, and 100 arguments and conversations thinned the air. The woman asked Mom how she had found me. Mom told them things she hadn't told me, but she kept quiet about the herbalist. The gathering began vying with loud voices, offering variations of similar stories they had heard about. A woman told of a wizard who had hidden a child in a green bottle. Another woman, who had been taking a noticeable interest in Dad, told of how her sister was found floating on a stream, her head crowned in sacrificial beads. "That's a lie," Mom said suddenly to everyone's astonishment. "He never told us she had a sister," Dad interrupted, picking up his bottle and spoon, creating a modest din. He got up and sang and danced. The men sang along with him the popular high life tune which mocked the eternal rivalries among women. Dad got carried away with his own song and tried to organize everyone into dancing. There was no space in which to move, and Dad, fairly drunk by now, became abusive to anyone who wasn't responsive. At first, it was a general sort of abuse, but when he got specific with one of the men, disruption set in. The man stormed out and a delegation had to be sent to beg him back. He came back, but before he resumed his floor space, he made sure of his vengeance. "Is it this wretched room you're so proud of?" he said loudly to Dad. "Big man, small brains." Dad smiled sheepishly. Then Mom rounded on him, asking him to be more polite to his guests. And she got so worked up in her inexplicable rage that she too stormed out, leaving the crowd somewhat confused. No one was sent out after her. Embarrassed by the silence, Dad invited everyone to pour themselves more drinks, and he proposed a toast to his wife. But the drinks had run out, and Dad had no money left, and we all sat staring at our empty bottles. In the brief silence, Mom returned, bringing relatives we hadn't seen for a long time. And the gathering cheered her return. And Dad, inspired by the cheering, hurried out of the room, ignoring Mom's protestations that we should celebrate within our means. Went to the shop across the street and came back with cartons of beer. The feast got rowdier. The men kept calling for more drinks. The old man, quite drunk, began a stream of contradictory proverbs. A man with a thick beard complained about how the smell of the food was making him lean, amidst all the voices, the anticipations which had topped themselves, the long patient waiting which in the end satisfies its own hunger. The food was served. Plates of rice and bushmeat passed before gluttonous faces. But because the crowd was so big, and numbers vastly outstripped Mom's mock calculations, everyone had much less food than suggested by the size of the bowl. People had talked themselves into such a hunger that the food barely went round. Like the miracle of multiplying fishes in reverse, the food diminished before it got to the guests. The rice was swiftly consumed, the bowl disappeared into the capacious stomachs of the ravenous gathering, the stew dried out in the pots, and people stared at their plates in drunken puzzlement. The bearded man grumbled that the meat he had eaten was so small that it had made him hungrier. Discontentment spread. The smell of the food, sumptuous and throat tickling, lingered in the air, reminding us of the betrayed promise of an abundant feast. Amid the discontentment, Dad tried hard to please everyone. He made jokes, told riddles, fell into impersonations. He danced and made music with his bottle. Meanwhile, people ate, spat their bones on the floor, spilled their drinks and wiped their hands on our curtains. Dad had plied the gathering with drinks, borrowing heavily, sweating in bizarre exultation. The bearded man, substituting drunkenness for hunger, drank so much that when he attempted to dramatize his first encounter with a white woman, he staggered and fell on his chair, breaking its back. Another man ran outside, threw up in the passage, and came back looking like a lizard. Dad, who was more than pleasantly drunk, held forth about the violence he would have unleashed if he had gone to the police officer's place to get me. Mom found the perfect moment for revenge. "Why didn't you go here?" she said cuttingly. "Because you were too drunk." There was another embarrassed silence. Dad, slightly cross-eyed with drunkenness, looked around at everyone. Then he displayed his arm in a sling. And then for no apparent reason, almost as if he was snatching riddles out of the air, he said, "When I die, no one will see my body." The silence became profound. Mom burst into tears and rushed out of the room. Two women went after her. Dad, entering a grim mood, drank intensely, and then suddenly began to sing beautifully. For the first time, I heard deep notes of sadness in his powerful voice. Still singing, he bent over, lifted me up and held me to him. His eyes were a little bloodshot. He gave me his glass to drink from, and after two gulps, I became quite drunk myself. Dad put me down on the chair, went outside and returned with Mom in his arms. Mom's eyes were wet. Dad held her, and they danced together, and the gathering, touched by the reconciliation, sang for them. While the room quivered with jagged drumming on the table, syncopated rhythms of voices, the bottle music and the general revelry, the photographer from across the road turned up wearing a white hat. His name was Jeremiah. He had a wiry beard and everyone seemed to know him. He became the instant butt of jokes. Some mocked his bad timing at missing the tastiest boat that ever ran amok in the forests. Others urged him to take off his white hat and get drunk as swiftly as possible. And the woman wanted to know why he hadn't brought his camera. He went back out and soon returned with his camera, and everyone abandoned the dancing and organized themselves for a group photograph. The men fought for the most visible positions. The old man, claiming right of seniority, posed in front of everyone. The women went out to brighten themselves and came back to disrupt the photographer's arrangement. Mom picked me up and posed with Dad next to the old man. The photographer gave me the instructions as he set up his camera. He went back and forth, making us contort our heads. He made Dad twist his legs, made Mom hold her neck at an awkward angle, and made me fix a quite insane smile on my face. After much fussing, the photographer proceeded to embark on his own set of dramatic poses. He crouched, stood on tiptoes, knelt, climbed on a chair, and even seemed to imitate an eagle in flight. He drank generously from a bottle of beer, swaying, leaning backwards, his eyes shining. He made us say, "She's..." While we played around with the word, fishing humor out of his strangeness, he took the first picture, and the camera flashed, followed by an odd explosion. The ghost emerged from the light and melted, stunned at his feet. I screamed. The crowd laughed. The photographer took 5 pictures in all, and the ghost kept falling at his feet. Dazed by the flash, when he went to his studio to drop off his camera, the ghost followed him. When he came back, they weren't with him. He joined the boisterous merriment and got wonderfully drunk. Not long afterwards, the landlord turned up. The crowd cheered him. Mom had to rustle up some food. Dad had to buy more drinks and credits. I was forced over and thrown up in the air till my ribs ached, and I was prayed for all over again. The photographer had to go back and get his camera. After much prancing and mystery making, as if he were a magician, the photographer lifted up his camera. He was surrounded by little ghosts and spirits. They had climbed on one another to take a closer look at the instrument. They were so fascinated by the camera that they climbed on him and hung on his arms and stood on his head. He was very drunk and he cheerfully took 3 pictures of the landlord with his fly whisk. When he had finished, he couldn't be bothered to go all the way back to his studio, so he hung the camera on a nail. The spirits and the children gathered around it, pointing and talking in amazed voices. The men who were drunk began a furious argument. Some of the women took their children to bed. The men were in the full flow of their loud voices when the curtain parted. A hush descended, and the madame from the bar stepped in. The landlord, on seeing her, made a frightened sound. Everyone stared at her in drunken silence. The spirits left the camera and surrounded the woman. They stayed at a distance. The woman smiled and waved a benevolent greeting to all of us. Dad got up and welcomed her warmly, found her a seat and proceeded to tell everyone about the fantastic beginnings of her myth. Everyone knew the story already, and they stared at her as at an august, if unpredictable, guest. Mom rustled up some food for her. Dad sent off for more drinks and credit. But it wasn't necessary, for she had bought 5 golds of palm wine to help celebrate my homecoming. When the Ogogoro's Dad sent for arrived, she took the bottle, stood up abruptly, sending waves of silence everywhere by the sheer force of her legend and her bulk. She held my hand and said, "Is this the boy we are celebrating?" "Yes," the crowd said. "Is this the boy who was lost and found?" "Yes." Then she turned. With her big eyes gazing at me steadily, she said, "The road will never swallow you. The river of your destiny will always overcome evil. May you understand your fate. Suffering will never destroy you, but will make you stronger. Success will never confuse you or scatter your spirit, but will make you fly higher into the good sunlight. Your life will always surprise you." Her prayer was so wonderful that everyone was silent afterwards. They stared at her in amazement. Then Dad, recovering from the shock of the word, said, "Amen." The gathering repeated it. The woman still standing made a libation, a short communal prayer. Then she drank half the bottle of Ogogoro in a single sustained gulp, her great breasts quivering in the hot room. When she had finished, she sat down, her fleshy face coming out in sweat. The spirits encompassed her, talking about her in astonished voices. She didn't stay very long, and went too soon for everyone's liking, for they wanted to decode her mystery. She got up and said she had to return to her bar. We all tried to persuade her to stay, but she was beyond persuading. Dad thanked her for coming. Mom thanked her for the prayers and the wine. As she went to the door, swaying like a great ship, she stopped, looked hard at me, and said, "You have a strange son. I like him." Then to me, she added, "Come and visit me one of these days, eh?" "I will," I said. When she left the room, the spirits went with her. That night, we found out her name. She was known as Madame Koto.
Chapter 12. After all the revelry, the feast ended with men asleep on the chairs, children sprawled on the floor, bottles everywhere, and bones on the windowsill. The photographer snored with his nose close to Dad's rescued boots, and the landlord drooled with flies around his ears. I was sitting against a wall, weaving in and out of sleep, surrounded by the confusion of human bodies, when I heard those sweet voices again. My spirit companions, their voices seductive beyond endurance, sang to me, asking me to honor my pact, to not be deceived by the forgetful celebrations of men, and to return to the land where feasting knows no end. They urged me on with their angelic voices, and I found myself floating over the bodies of drunken men and out into the night. I walked on the wings of beautiful songs, down the street without the faintest notion of where the voices were leading me. I floated down the bush paths and came to a well that was covered with a broad plank. On the plank, there was a big stone. I tried to move the stone but couldn't. I floated round and round our area. My feet ached. I stopped and saw my toes bleeding. I did not panic. I felt no pain. Soon I was at the edge of the great forest, whose darkness is a god. I was about to enter the darkness when I saw the black cat, its eyes glowing like luminous stones. Then footsteps converged on me. I turned and ran into the massive figure of Madame Koto. She caught me, lifted me up to her heavy breast, and took me back home in silence. Mom had been looking for me everywhere. When she saw us, she rushed over, carried me across the men asleep in their chairs, the children dozing against the wall, and laid me on the bed. Madame Koto lit a stick of incense, shut the window, and went outside with my mom. I heard Madame Koto telling her how she had found me. I listened to the men snoring. I heard Mom thanking Madame Koto. My spirit companions were weeping. I slept and woke up when I heard a noise at the door. Someone came in with a lamp. I saw the lamp and its illumination, but I didn't see who was bearing it across the room. There was darkness behind the lamp. Darkness put the lamp on the table. The curtain fluttered. I lay still and waited. Nothing happened for a while. When I woke up, the lamp was gone. In its place, there was a candle on a saucer. I saw Dad moving from one sleeping figure to another, waking them up, urging them to go home. The men were so drunk that they didn't want to move. The children had to be carried out in their sleeping positions. When Dad came round to the photographer and touched him on the shoulder, the poor man jumped up and said, "Where's the riot? Where's my camera?" Dad laughed. The photographer shook his head, groped for his camera among Dad's shoes, couldn't find it, and cried out. He eventually found the camera in the empty pot of stew, amongst the bones of the boar. He snatched it out, cleaned it with his shirt, and staggered off to his studio. When the landlord was waking up, he jerked his head, looked around suspiciously, and said, "Where's my rent?" Then he climbed into bed and put his arm around me, as if I were a woman. Dad dragged him out into the passage and left him to his devices. In the room, the bearded man woke up and wondered if the feast had begun yet, and asked why he hadn't been served any boar's meat. One of the children started crying.
When Dad came back into the room, the bearded man asked for some beer. Dad drove him out. It was only after they had gone that we saw the debris of the feast. Our clothes were scattered everywhere. Two chairs were broken, glasses had been shattered on the floor, and it was a wonder that no one had cut themselves. Someone had vomited half out of the window and half in. The place stank of the children who had wet themselves in their sleep. Mosquitoes whined. Dad lit a coil. Mom swept the floor, arranged the clothes, cleared out the plates, cutlery and bones. Then she disinfected the room. Dad sat on his chair, drinking and smoking quietly. Mom spread out the mat. Then she blew out the candle and went to sleep. Dad sat alone in the dark. Every now and again, he said, "We have kept our promise." The only points of light were the mosquito coil, its smoke spiraling to the ceiling, and his cigarette. In a way, I came to think of Dad as a cigarette smoked alone in the dark. I watched him that night as if he were a fabled being. Sometimes he got up and paced the room, perfectly avoiding Mom's sleeping form, his cigarette vanishing and reappearing. I watched him go back and forth. As I watched him, the darkness expanded. I saw Dad's cigarette at one end of the room and heard him pacing at the other end. It seemed he had become separate from his action, and I saw multiples of him smoking at different corners of the room. I shut my eyes. When I opened them, it was morning and Dad was in his chair, asleep. I turned over. I heard him creaking his joints. When I turned round again, Mom was up, the mat was gone, the room was clean. The mosquito coil was just an aluminium stand and a spiral of ash on the center table. And Dad was no longer asleep in his chair.